This episode is sponsored by Lyft. I'm going to be traveling quite a bit this year for book launches and live pod events. And even before Lyft became a sponsor of TCSA, they were always my first airline choice. And it's not just because they have complimentary onboard snacks and free Vita coffee on every flight, although that is a huge plus. It's also their easy penalty-free fee changes and cancellations, because sometimes an extra interview opportunity or event comes up at the last minute and I have to change my flights. Lyft also offers flight discounts for kids under 12, which sadly I stopped qualifying for 32 years ago, but are super useful for parents, I'm sure. And there's a premium offering ideal for business travelers and frequent flyers alike. And as a huge animal lover, I can't help but be swayed by their policy that your small dog can travel on board too. Lyft is helping to take True Crime South Africa to new heights. So visit lyft.co.za to view or book daily Lyft flights between Cape Town, Durban and Joburg. T's and C's apply. And a huge thank you to Lyft for your support of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Luto Denisile and Anna Olofse for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. These special episodes are a new feature to the podcast. Last time, I covered the initial information about human trafficking in part one of this special series. This week, I'm going to be diving deeper into some of the specific modus operandi that traffickers use. And if you're missing your usual full case episodes, don't worry, I'll be back with one soon. If you haven't heard, my new book, Sizzlers, The Hate Crime That Tore Sea Point Apart, was released in May, and I've been super busy with events around the book. But I'm catching up and things will be back to normal soon. I do hope you're finding value in these special episodes. I've received a ton of feedback saying that you are, so this will be a regular feature dotted among the full case episodes. As a reminder, the sources I use for these episodes include the Samlit report, several academic paper resources, and articles from the Savamus publication. So, let's get into your True Crime South Africa special, Human Trafficking, Part 2.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
In the first part of this series on human trafficking, we looked at some of the major types of human trafficking, the number and types of cases that were prosecuted in South Africa, and the gender splits of the victims in those cases. But what about the gender of the perpetrators? I'm sure many of you, when I say human trafficker, picture a man. Just as when we initially picture the act of trafficking, as I mentioned in the previous part, we picture someone being physically abducted and thrown into the back of a vehicle. And as on that count, we'd be wrong about the gender of most human trafficking perpetrators, at least at certain levels. According to the Refinitiv World Check Risk Intelligence Database, the data of which was collected up till February 2022, 80% of the perpetrators of human trafficking are female. Now, before our brains explode, I will also say that the same data shows that the vast majority of those who are actually carrying out the modern-day slavery implementation of these trafficked victims are male. So, most of the lower rungs, the people physically involved in grooming these victims and transporting them, are female. But the end users and the people actually making the calls, so to speak, are male. In addition to that, many of the female perpetrators were at one point in their lives trafficked themselves. And although that certainly doesn't excuse their involvement, it is an added complication. But we also know from the stats we heard in part one that the gender split between trafficking victims is very even, and sometimes even heavily swayed to male victims in some forms of trafficking. So it's interesting that male victims don't seem to be coming full vicious circle and becoming perpetrators. Of course, there's another reason that women are perhaps more successful at trafficking than men, because we tend to trust them more. Both men and women would likely be far less wary of a female than a male. It's been shown time and again when we exhibit shock and horror over any major crime involving women. Ghislaine Maxwell, convicted sex trafficker and right-hand woman to sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, is a good example of this. We were horrified, of course, at his actions, but the public outrage at her involvement in recruiting and harming young women was undoubtedly even greater. Rather interesting, isn't it? We also may have incorrect preconceptions about what nationalities are most likely to be perpetrators of human trafficking. Now, this data is difficult to call 100% accurate, because it's only going to be as accurate as that country's own reporting around the issue. But the data that is available indicates that perpetrators most commonly originate from India, Colombia, the USA, China, Brazil, Canada, Vietnam, Romania, Peru, United Kingdom, and Russia. There are 25 countries in the world that are considered hotspots for human trafficking. The top five of those 25 are the USA, India, China, Colombia, and Italy. In an African context, Nigerians and South Africans are the continent's most frequent perpetrators of human trafficking. Countries in Africa are usually sources of victims, with the trafficking destinations often being Europe, especially Italy. As I mentioned earlier, women tend to form the worker levels of human trafficking in recruitment and transportation, while men are usually in the higher up positions and physically abusing the victims in various ways when they reach their destinations. The men involved in trafficking are often professionals and either own or manage their own companies. They're most commonly involved in the beauty or spa industry, textile manufacturing, heads of religious institutions, or involved in the import or export of goods. The female perpetrators most commonly represent themselves as unemployed, but many are in professions such as the entertainment industry, the financial sector, and there have been instances in South Africa particularly where female perpetrators were members of the SAPS or SANDF. If we bring the view down even closer within South Africa, the Western Cape is the biggest hotspot for human trafficking in the country. It's followed by Gauteng, then the Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and then the Free State. The gender splits of victims of trafficking usually also lends itself to various reasons that victims are trafficked. Male victims are often used to work in modern slavery situations and forced labor, in construction, factories, farming, and fishing, while female victims are more often used for domestic servitude or sexual exploitation. In cases where women are in forced labor situations, they're often found in the hospitality industry and the tourism sector. And again, I don't think we think about this very often. When we hear that illegal immigrants are working in construction situations, for instance, this doesn't always mean that those people purposefully travel to a country illegally with the intent that they would be working for a probably incredibly meager wage. Many of those individuals may well have been trafficked. They may not have known what the intended destination was, and they were very likely given a very different story about what they would be doing and how much they would be earning. The same could be the case with the woman cleaning your hotel room on your island holiday. Is she really there by choice? And if so, was that choice informed and truly consented to? Heartbreakingly, male children are often trafficked to perform begging work. People are far more likely to give money to children, and once they age out of the period where they appear vulnerable enough, who knows what happens to them. The more I delve down into this topic, the more these bits of information I find blow my mind. Things I had never even considered could involve human trafficking do. People and perpetrators I would never have thought of horrify me in their vulnerability. For instance, in Africa, it's not just citizens of a particular country that are vulnerable to fall victim to trafficking. As an example, Chinese traffickers who come into South Africa often specifically target Asian people living or working here as forced labor in their factories. Thai women form the largest victim group of trafficked victims in South Africa. One of the most shocking pieces of information I found in researching this topic was that it is believed that the Cuban government were involved in trafficking doctors and other healthcare professionals from Cuba into our country during the COVID-19 pandemic. The nature of this trafficking situation appears to be that the doctors were not properly informed about why they were coming to South Africa. They were not made aware of the conditions they would be working under. They essentially did not have a choice in whether they came here or not. And 85% of the salaries they earned during the time that they were working in our country was taken by the Cuban government. The major cities in our country, including Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Durban, are usually the biggest hotspots for trafficking. Although victims may be found in these cities, it's also common for victims to be brought in from more rural areas into the cities for the purposes of trafficking. There's also a lot of movement over our borders, especially around the Kruger Park, where traffickers move people through preset routes to get them into South Africa illegally to traffic them. Is it just me, or are you listeners also having a bit of a mind-blown moment with understanding how all of this stuff is just happening around us and right under our noses. We think of human trafficking as this insidious thing that happens in the shadows, but that is clearly not true. It could very well be everywhere we look, because it takes so many different forms. As we do with people in abusive relationships, we may find ourselves asking, well, why don't these people just leave these situations? Well, besides the obvious vulnerabilities of being in a foreign country, likely undocumented, and having little to no resources to make such an escape, there are additional methods of control and coercion that traffickers use to ensure victims cannot leave or raise the alarm. One of the most common forms of control is debt bondage, where victims are trafficked in the belief that they're going to well-paying jobs, but when they get there, they're told they need to pay exorbitant fees for recruitment, traveling, accommodation, and living expenses. This means the victims get little to no financial compensation for their work, and they have no way to escape their situation. In addition, substances and sexual abuse are often used as methods of control. Traffickers may cause victims to become addicted to drugs or alcohol and then control their access to the substance. Violence and threats of violence toward the victim and their family are also used to control victims as well as other types of threats. In cases where victims have been trafficked out of particularly poor countries with little to no prospects there, although they've been coerced and are not in the situation they initially bought into when they left their home country, they may not want to go back because they still hope that they could build a life for themselves in their destination country. The traffickers use this hope to control the victims too, and will often threaten to report them to authorities. As far as trafficking for the purposes of sexual exploitation goes, the perpetrator situation within South Africa shows a slightly different slant depending on what data set you look at. The US Department of State Trafficking in Persons report claims that their data shows perpetrators of sex trafficking in South Africa are predominantly from Nigeria, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ghana. South Africa's data, after following the money, indicates that perpetrators are predominantly South African and Nigerian. In addition, it shows that very often perpetrators, especially those who are female, source victims from within their own families. The most common ploy is to convince these victims that they've been offered jobs at bed and breakfast establishments. Many of the places that have been raided, which are fronts for sex trafficking, do actually present as bed and breakfasts up front. So the victims are lulled into a false sense of security before eventually figuring out that they're in a situation they hadn't agreed to. Vulnerabilities within victims are often targeted by traffickers, with data showing that members of the LGBTQ+ community, migrants, disabled persons, pregnant women, and children are commonly targeted. Of course, with us all being online so much more now, traffickers have shifted their recruitment techniques to the digital world, and specifically social media. This surged hugely during the COVID-19 pandemic, when so many of us were spending far more time online than ever before. Of course, people's vulnerabilities were also increased during that time, as so many people lost income or their jobs entirely, felt incredibly lonely, and were uncertain and afraid about what was happening in the world. People with substance use issues were also incredibly vulnerable during that time, as they were unable to get access to their ordinary substances. In South Africa, this included alcohol and nicotine products. Loss of income was weaponized by traffickers online during this time, and several trafficking rings started to auction off women for sexual services. Of course, this wasn't how it was presented. Rather, the advertisement was staged as a way to help women who had lost their jobs or some of their income as a result of the pandemic and lockdown. Those entering the auction were told that they would be paying for companion services, which all sounded very sedate. In reality, these were trafficking rings, which would see desperate women leaving their homes, risking their lives, and engaging in activities they had not consented to. This is just one example of how traffickers lure victims online. In a country like South Africa, where unemployment is so high, of course, the lures are often based on job offers or educational opportunities. There are Facebook pages which claim to advertise jobs in prominent companies or government departments, and these are very often, at least, scams, or, at worst, the start of trafficking operations. It's vital to double-check that these vacancies are actually being offered by the company themselves, if that is the claim. And keep your eyes open for specific red flags like recruiters claiming to be from a company but using a Gmail or other throwaway email address. In addition to fake job offers, traffickers also use love and romance as ways to target victims. You may well have heard of the term romance scams, which are usually carried out by scammers who form relationships with men and women online and then use those relationships to scam the victim out of money. These scammers catfish the victim by pretending to be an attractive and successful man or woman and using photographs stolen from other people to promote the ruse. And while these romance scams are bad enough, traffickers also use very similar methods to lure victims out of their homes and to a destination in order to traffic them. Such tactics take place over months and sometimes even years, and result in the victim believing they're actually in a relationship with the other individual, and therefore being willing to do whatever they may ask. Other horrific forms of targeting the vulnerable online include offers of assistance to people with substance use issues, the homeless, or runaway children. Any offer of free rehabilitation or housing, unless it can be verified as being valid and through a recognized NPO, should definitely be viewed with skepticism. Of course, the nature of being vulnerable through these difficulties means that one would be desperate and more likely to just take a chance. And that's what traffickers bank on. Trafficking female children and teenagers for the purposes of forced marriage is a huge issue globally, but specifically on the African continent. According to the International Labour Organization, in 2016, there were an estimated 15.4 million people living in forced marriages across the world. African countries make up 15 of the 20 most common countries in the world where this form of trafficking occurs. While male children are also occasionally subjected to this form of trafficking, it does overwhelmingly impact females, and 44% of victims were under the age of 15 when they were trafficked into forced marriages. An ancient African cultural practice called ukutwala has been weaponized in African countries to put a cultural face on the acts of abduction, rape, and forced marriage. According to the South African Department of Justice, ukutwala, which is an ancient tradition in which young women would be taken from their parents' homes and delivered to the homes of families who wished to marry them off to a male relative. Although the original practice never involved any form of violence or rape, and more often than not, the woman and her family had already been in discussion with the man's family and were aware that ukutwala may occur. Today, Increasing incidents are being reported of girls and women disappearing from their homes, and when they are recovered, the perpetrators claim the cultural practice of ukutwala. Very often these instances include violence toward the victim, including rape, despite the original practice strictly prohibiting any sexual activity before the arranged marriage occurred. This, of course, is just an example of predators weaponizing cultural and religious practices for their own gain. The Department of Justice on its website makes it clear that no cultural or religious practice in South Africa is above the law, and everyone in South Africa has the basic human rights of not being subjected to forced or coerced marriage, and any sexual activity occurring in such a situation is legally considered rape. Trafficking persons for the purposes of organ harvesting is another growing concern across the world. South Africa in particular has become a favoured destination for people from other parts of the world to come to for organ transplants. And we have to ask why. Yes, we do have excellent doctors and surgical expertise here. Foreign doctors often come to our universities to learn certain techniques and procedures because we do have such a great skill set. And perhaps it may be cheaper for someone from a country like the US, for instance, to have an organ transplant done here, even if they paid private rates. But where are the organs coming from? In 2015, it was revealed that a high-profile private hospital in KwaZulu-Natal was running an illegal kidney transplant scheme with a group of doctors. This was happening right out in the open, and little is known about how the kidneys came to be in the doctor's possession. We've also seen reports about South Africans going missing overseas when they believed they were going to teach or undertake other jobs there, and allegations surround those cases that the individuals were actually trafficked for their organs. The practice of muti in South Africa, which again, at the base of the tradition, does not call for the use of human body parts, but again, is often weaponized to serve the purposes of traffickers, can also mask the trafficking of organs. Although these organs would probably not even be usable for implantation if they're not harvested at a medical facility, I know of at least one case where a woman killed a child to harvest organs and sold them, not for muti, but for implantation into unsuspecting recipients who believed they were getting working organs and paid very good money for them. The more I dig down into this world of trafficking, the more I can't help but be horrified at how this is all just happening right under our noses. How many missing people have been trafficked? I often speak about really vulnerable people for various reasons on my podcast who've gone missing without a trace. And now, I really can't help but wonder if this is an option we should be looking at far more seriously. I guess what I've really taken away from this special series so far is that trafficking doesn't look like we think it does. The victims aren't in cages being tortured. They could be the doctor who treated your COVID, or the woman tidying up your Airbnb. And the perpetrators most certainly aren't terrifying monsters we'd be able to spot at 10 paces either. They're our neighbours, our employers, our friends, and sometimes even our family members. There's definitely going to be a third part to this series at some point. I'll be releasing some normal episodes first and then probably get back to this later in June. The education I'm getting from this is probably going to be vital in cases I cover in the future, and I hope that you are getting as much value from it too. Please do pop me your comments, experiences, and reactions to this special series on social media. Your engagement helps to improve future coverage. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.